This is a Kim Munson Liberty and Economy briefing. 7 weeks from massacre to missiles, how Iran's regime sealed its own fate. The Islamic Republic massacred 7,000 of its own people, then lost its supreme leader to the strikes that followed. 70 years of U.S.-Iran history explain why that sequence matters. 7 weeks before American and Israeli warplanes hit Tehran, Iran's Islamic Republic answered its own people's demand for economic relief with snipers on rooftops. The January massacres killed more than 7,000 Iranians by name and forfeited whatever legitimacy the regime still claimed. On February 28, 2026, the United States and Israel launched a massive joint military operation, the biggest combat sortie in Israeli Air Force history, to strike the regime that had turned its guns on its own people. This time, unlike 1953, the justification did not have to be invented. The regime supplied it, the coup that started everything. On August 19, 1953, the military overthrew Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in a plot engineered by British intelligence, Operation Boot, and the CIA, Operation Ajax. The stated rationale was Cold War urgency. British and American officials concluded Mossadegh had communist sympathies, according to History.com. The deeper motive was oil. Mossadegh had nationalized Iran's petroleum industry, threatening the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, the predecessor to BP. It was the first time the United States used the CIA to overthrow a democratically elected civilian government, as historian Stephen Kinzer has documented. Kermit Roosevelt Jr., grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, ran the operation from inside Tehran. The CIA sent Major General Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. to persuade the exiled Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi to return, then trained the security forces that became SAVAK, the Shah's feared secret police. The Shah was grateful. "I owe my throne to God, my people, my army, and to you," he told Roosevelt, according to Roosevelt's own account. As thanks, the Shah signed over 40% of Iran's oil fields to U.S. companies, according to History.com. Oil revenues jumped from $34 million in 1954 to $55.1 million by 1956 to 57. The Shah became one of America's most trusted Cold War allies, and U.S. military aid poured into Iran for the next quarter century. 60 years later, the CIA formally acknowledged its role. Declassified documents obtained by the National Security Archive at George Washington University showed the coup was carried out under CIA direction and, as an act of U.S. foreign policy, conceived and approved at the highest levels of government. CIA historian David Robarge assessed that the agency had transformed a turbulent constitutional monarchy into an absolutist kingship and induced a succession of unintended consequences. The revolution America made inevitable. The Shah ruled for 25 years with American backing and SAVAK enforcement. His secret police monitored dissidents, carried out censorship, and tortured suspected opponents. Nearly 100 people were executed for political reasons during the last two decades of his rule, according to declassified records. His White Revolution of 1963 brought land reform and women's suffrage, but it also displaced millions of peasants into urban slums, where they became recruits for the revolution to come. By the 1970s, Iran was wealthier than its neighbors, but seething with resentment. In 1978, anti-Shah and anti-American protests erupted across the country. In January 1979, the Shah fled. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini returned from exile in Paris to lead what became the Islamic Revolution, replacing a Western-backed monarchy with an anti-Western theocracy. The revolution's anti-American character was rooted in living memory of 1953. On November 4, 1979, student militants stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, demanding Washington extradite the Shah, who had been granted asylum by the Carter administration for cancer treatment. 66 Americans were seized, 52 were held for 444 days. As History.com noted, nationalism, not communism, proved to be the most serious threat to U.S. power in Iran. What followed was 47 years of theocratic rule, a nuclear program that the IAEA said by December 2024, had stockpiled enough highly enriched uranium for multiple weapons on short notice, proxy wars through Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis, and death to America, elevated to state policy. As NBC News observed, the 1953 coup sowed the seeds of 1979's Islamic Revolution, and with it the anti-Western repressive theocracy of Iran today. 7,000 names. On December 28, 2025, shopkeepers at the Aladdin shopping center in Tehran walked out. The Iranian rial had sunk to a record low of $145 million per U.S. dollar. Annual inflation stood at 42%. Food prices had risen 72%. Within days, protests spread to more than 100 cities in what became the largest uprising since the 1979 revolution, according to accounts compiled from multiple news agencies. Students at Shahid Beheshti University in Tehran captured the mood. "This criminal system has taken our future hostage for 47 years. It won't be changed with reform or with false promises." What came next was not reform. On January 9, Ayatollah Khamenei ordered the Supreme National Security Council to crush the protests by any means necessary, according to the New York Times. On January 8 and 9, security forces including the IRGC and its Basij militia carried out organized mass shootings with snipers on rooftops. Amnesty International described it as unprecedented massacres during protest dispersals. The human rights activists' news agency known as HRANA published a report titled "The Crimson Winter" on February 23, 2026. It confirmed 7,007 deaths by name, 6,488 adult protesters, 2,036 minors, 2,007 security force members, and 76 non-participants. Another 11,740 court cases remained under review. Time reported that civilian hospital records showed more than 30,000 protest-related deaths on January 8 and 9 alone. Iran International estimated the overall toll at approximately 36,500, though independent verification of these figures remains ongoing. Authorities imposed a near-total internet shutdown. NetBlocks measured connectivity at 4% of normal levels. Amnesty International documented nighttime curfews, thousands of arrests from homes and hospitals, forced confessions on state television, and mass burials without family notification. Diana El-Tahawi of Amnesty International said authorities were deliberately isolating over 90 million people from the rest of the world to conceal their crimes. Bahar Sava of Human Rights Watch called it the deadliest protest crackdown that led to unprecedented mass killings of thousands of protesters and bystanders. On January 29, 2026, the European Union unanimously designated the IRGC as a terrorist organization, placing it alongside ISIS and Al-Qaeda on the EU terrorist list, according to Al Jazeera. Iran retaliated by designating EU armies as terrorist groups, from negotiating table to target list. Even as Iranians were dying in the streets, diplomats were talking. Nuclear negotiations had begun in April 2025 in Muscat, Oman, with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi communicating through Omani mediators. Three rounds were held in 2025, interrupted by the June 2025 Israel-Iran 12-day war. Talks resumed in February 2026. On February 6, indirect negotiations reconvened in Muscat. Jared Kushner and Admiral Brad Cooper joined the U.S. side. Ali Larijani joined the Iranian delegation. A second round opened in Geneva on February 26. On February 27, Oman's Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi announced a breakthrough. Iran had agreed to never stockpile enriched uranium to full IAEA verification and to irreversibly downgrade its enriched uranium to the lowest level possible. Al-Busaidi said peace was within reach. Hours later, the IAEA discovered Iran had hidden highly enriched uranium in an underground facility undamaged in the previous round of fighting. At approximately 9:45 a.m., Iran Standard Time on February 28, airstrikes began. Israel codenamed the operation Roaring Lion. The Pentagon called it Operation Epic Fury. the Israeli Air Force said it struck 500 military targets across western and central Iran using approximately 200 fighter jets, the largest combat sortie in IAF history. U.S. warships launched Tomahawk cruise missiles. The Army deployed HIMARS launchers. Ayatollah Khamenei was killed in a strike on his compound. Iranian state media confirmed his death early on March 1 and declared 40 days of mourning. CBS News reported that 40 Iranian officials died in the strikes. The IDF confirmed the deaths of 7 senior security leaders, including Defense Council Secretary Ali Shemkhani, Defense Minister Aziz Nasser Zadeh, and IRGC Commander Mohammad Pakpour. At 2:30 a.m. Eastern, President Trump released an 8-minute video. "When we're finished, take over your government," he told the Iranian people. "It will be yours to take. This will be probably your only chance for generations." He told the IRGC to lay down your weapons and have complete immunity, or, in the alternative, face certain death. Iran strikes back. Iran retaliated within hours. The IRGC launched ballistic missiles and drones at U.S. military installations across the Persian Gulf. According to Al Jazeera, Iran struck the U.S. Navy 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain, Al Udaidi Air Base in Qatar, Al Dhafr Air Base in the UAE, and Ali Al Salim Air Base in Kuwait. Strikes also hit Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, and Israel. CENTCOM stated it suffered no casualties and that light damage had not disrupted operations, according to the Navy Times. It neutralized several hundred Iranian drone and missile strikes. The Iranian Red Crescent reported 2,001 civilians killed and 747 injured inside Iran. In the UAE, strikes hit residential areas near Dubai Marina, according to Al Jazeera. The IRGC closed the Strait of Hormuz to shipping. According to a Reuters report cited by EU Operation Aspides officials, vessels received radio messages, "No ship is allowed to pass the Strait of Hormuz." 8 countries closed their airspace. The only Gulf Cooperation Council country Iran did not strike was Oman, which had served as mediator. Oman's Foreign Minister Al-Busahidi had a message for Washington: "This is not your war." Why this time is not 1953? The critical difference between 2026 and every previous American intervention in the Middle East is who asked for it. In 1953, Iranians did not want regime change. It was imposed on a functioning democracy for the benefit of Western oil companies. In December 2025, Iranians were dying in the streets for it. The regime forfeited its claim to govern through the January massacres, and tens of millions of Iranians made that judgment before a single American bomb fell. That distinction matters because the historical record is unforgiving when outsiders impose change on populations that did not choose it. In Iraq in 2003, President George W.W. Bush declared, "Mission accomplished." After the fall of Saddam Hussein, Iraq descended into insurgency and sectarian civil war. In Libya in 2011, NATO airstrikes helped topple Muammar Gaddafi, but within 3 years, the country collapsed into civil war. Iran's regime earned the same fate through its own savagery, but the transition still carries risks that honest analysis cannot ignore. There is no opposition government in exile waiting to step in. The most organized group, the People's Mojahideen Organization of Iran, known as MEK, is widely reviled inside Iran, in part because it aligned with Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. A State Department spokesperson stated in 2022 that the United States does not see the MEK as a viable democratic opposition movement that is representative of the Iranian people. CIA assessments suggest that a hardliner from the IRGC could try to fill the vacuum. Linda Robinson of the Council on Foreign Relations cautioned, "Taking out Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is not the same as regime change. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is the regime. The unarmed Iranian people do not have the means to topple a sophisticated and deeply entrenched repressive military apparatus like the IRGC." Ray Taki, also of CFR, noted that the Islamic Republic is an ideological system with a multi-layered elite and base of support. But the regime's own actions may have answered those concerns. The IRGC turned its guns on the Iranian people in January, and the people kept marching. The conscript soldiers who carried out the massacres are not the same as the ideological core, and the regime's willingness to murder 7,000 of its own citizens suggests a government that had already lost control of everything except its capacity for violence. President Trump's message to the IRGC, offering immunity for those who lay down their weapons, was aimed directly at that fracture. What hangs in the balance? The economic consequences are already measurable. The Strait of Hormuz, through which roughly 20% of the world's oil passes, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, is closed. Brent crude stood at $72.48 per barrel before the strikes. Analysts expect a $10 to $20 jump, potentially pushing prices toward $100 if hostilities persist. Approximately 50,000 American troops are stationed across the Gulf, the biggest Air Force presence in the Middle East since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Every one of them is within range of Iranian missiles that Iran has already shown a willingness to use. The nuclear calculus is no less volatile. President Trump declared Iran's nuclear program totally obliterated after the June 2025 strikes. 8 months later, the IAEA discovered hidden enriched uranium, and the administration cited the continuing threat to justify a second round of military action. As Max Boot, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote, "It's easy to start a war. It's very hard to end one successfully. That is a lesson that President George W. Bush learned in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is a lesson that President Donald Trump is likely to learn anew in Iran. Destroyed centrifuges can be rebuilt, but a regime that massacred its own people may not be able to rebuild its authority. The nuclear program was the justification for the strikes, but the January massacres were the moral warrant." Stephen A. Cook, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, called it a risky strategy given the enormous challenges of trying to engineer regime change from thousands of miles away. The counterargument is that the Iranian people had already begun the engineering themselves. The strikes removed the obstacle. Takiye noted that the Iranians were engaged in serious negotiations and trying to be imaginative in addressing U.S. concerns before the strikes. The discovery of hidden enriched uranium on February 27 collapsed that narrative. Whether diplomatic progress was genuine or a stalling tactic is now an academic question. The regime's leadership that would have implemented any deal no longer exists. The Iranian people paid a staggering price for this moment. They paid for it with 7,007 names on a list, and thousands more that may never be counted. They marched against 42% inflation and a currency worth less every day, and their government answered with snipers on rooftops. The regime sealed its own fate in the 7 weeks between the first massacre and the first missile. The lesson of 1953 is not that regime change always fails. It is that change imposed against a population's will produces a backlash that takes decades to resolve. This time, the population was already in the streets. What comes next depends on whether Washington treats the Iranian people as the protagonists of their own revolution or as bystanders to an American operation. The first path leads somewhere new. The second leads back to 1953. And now, Kim's perspective. The Iranian people have earned their freedom in blood, with more than 7,000 confirmed dead for the simple demand of economic dignity and a government that does not murder its own citizens. That moral clarity matters, and it should not be diluted. But moral clarity about a regime's crimes is not the same as confidence that outside military force will produce a free society. The 1953 coup is Exhibit A. The last time Washington installed a government in Tehran, it created the theocracy we are now trying to destroy. The best outcome is that Iranians, who have shown extraordinary courage, build what comes next themselves. The worst outcome is that we repeat the pattern and spend the next 47 years dealing with the consequences. For the full article with sources and links, visit kimmonson.com. This has been a Kim Monson Liberty and Economy Briefing.